passing down the avenue. I'm hiding out in the big city blinking. What was I thinking when I let go of you?
This is What We're Reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski, and I am being joined now by fellow music and book lovers, KAXE KBXE music director Kari Hedlund and Center Stage Minnesota producer and host Brett Carter. We're going to discuss Jeff Tweedy's new memoir, Let's Go So We Can Get Back, a memoir of recording and discording with Wilco, etc. This memoir is a candid journey starting in Tweedy's childhood town of Belleville, Illinois. It takes us to the rock clubs and live music circuit that informed his songwriting and performing career, and it includes the collaboration and discord with various bandmates and Uncle Tupelo and Wilco. Tweedy doesn't leave much out. The book includes stories about his wife, Susie, and his sons, Spencer and Sammy, his health problems, drug addiction, and the death of his father. Kari, let's start with you. What did you think of this book?
I thought this book was a very easy read, and I loved the insight that Jeff added about songwriting, how he writes songs, how he writes music, his musings, his funny one-liners. I actually felt like, Brett, you might feel Jeff on his sense of humor a little bit.
I did. I actually identified with him as a person, you know, because I'm not a songwriter, I'm not a musician, but I really identified with him as a person. His parents had similarities to mine. His life had similarities to mine, and he had a lot of lines that I wish I had written.
I think he really sets off the tone in the beginning of the book where he's like, I'm not going to talk about the band problems with the Jays. I'm not going to talk about my drug addiction. And he's like, of course I'm going to talk about
just kidding.
Kind of set the tone for me.
It'd be like reading a Keith Richards book and not hearing about the rock and roll.
Exactly. I'll have to put up a picture. We've got a copy of the book right here in the studio, and Brett Carter has marked all the one-liners that he loved, and it's an impressive
set. It's a lot of them.
It's an impressive array. We'll put a picture of that up online.
So the thing is, I'll just tell you about that. I have other books that look like this too, and when I get to something, it's not always about when I get to something that I want to remember because it was so insightful or so interesting. It's because it was said in such a unique way. So a lot of those marks are things like that, which wouldn't want to spend a lot of time talking about that part because, for example, he had a line in there when he was talking about in order for Wilco to be successful, he says, I'm going to have to... What does he say, the first part? I'm going to have to kill Dave Grohl is what it was. But what was it? Eat his heart. It's something like that.
Because the Foo Fighters beat him out in both the alternative rock category for Grammy and the rock category for Grammy. And the Foo Fighters got him both times. So
right. And yeah. So just the way he said it, I need to kill and eat the heart of Dave Grohl. There it is. And no, it's those kind of lines that I love reading in a book. It's those kind of lines that I love in songs, which explains why his music is appealing to lots of people, because he has these one-liners that if you're reading a book or if you're listening to a song, it strikes you at the moment. You kind of get stuck and you say, wow, that was cool how he wrote that. That's really fun.
One of my favorite one-liners from him was he was talking about how Uncle Tupelo, the name, he sort of always appreciated the name Uncle Tupelo, and how a lot of band names have just really pretty lame names, actually. And what he liked about Uncle Tupelo is that people didn't really know what they were going to hear. And he was talking about the Sex Pistols, and he said, nobody in the history of human listening heard a Sex Pistols song and thought, well, this is surprising. I was expecting more cello.
Yes, it's very good.
So I loved his one-liners.
And I think that's the whole tone of the book. That's really the whole tone of the book, is that it's even in his worst moments, when he's talking about the pharmacy guy who's handing him bags of pills for free, you know, even in the worst moments, he has these comments, these side comments about, like, why is this happening? How is that? This shouldn't be right, but I'm happy to take it as long as he's willing to provide. So I don't trust him as the narrator, which I think is appropriate for any memoir.
Any memoir. Right?
You know, I don't trust him, but I feel pretty a lot of allegiance with him, that he's not necessarily, I think he's telling the truth as well as he understands it in his life. So it's really interesting that way.
And in the epilogue, he kind of discusses that a little bit about the he's got the worst memory of his bandmates. You know, he goes to a theater and is like, wow, this is a beautiful theater. Did they just renovate it? And his bandmates told him like 8 stories of the last 8 times they've been to the theater. And,
one of which was a week ago.
Right? And so he acknowledges that his memory is a bit fuzzy when it comes to certain things, but he just kind of talked a little bit about in writing this book, he was surprised at the things he did remember and the things that were so specific, the memories that were really specific about growing up. So I appreciated that he acknowledged that it was like, you know, our memories are not infallible.
Well, I have a question for you guys, because you are both in the Wilco time frame. I'm pre-Wilco, and so I don't have the big allegiance that you could or could not have. I don't know if you do or not. But tell me about that. What's it like to read? Obviously, I would guess you know this band pretty well. And I didn't. So it's a different read for me. That's why I'm reading about him, not about Wilco. And right. What's that like for you guys?
One thing that really struck me was how he seemed to not gloss over, but the songwriting and the creating of the songs and the lyrics, kind of not a big deal. I mean, he talked about the process of how some songs got created. But these are songs that I think are incredible and that really kind of informed my music taste today. And he's like, well, you know, we come up with a melody and then the lyrics fit in. And that brought me down a little bit.
Did it? That's interesting.
Yeah. But I still appreciate those songs. But it was revealing to learn that from him.
That he sits with the melody for a while and like mumbles words. Yeah. That was so interesting. Yeah. He listens with the song for days at times doing mumbling words. And the words sometimes come from those mumbles. And that was very interesting process to me. And he goes kind of in depth about certain songs and how they sort of come together, which I thought was really fascinating. Yeah, that whole lyric thing was interesting as a fan. One of the songs he talked about writing was one of the first songs that he loved of his own called Gun. And this was in like Uncle Tupelo, maybe right at 1989-ish. And I sort of love how much he loved that song. And he kind of talked a little bit about how he came into his own as a songwriter. And there were the Screen Door song he talks about and sort of a lighter song, if you will. And then he talks about some other ones. It's almost like you can feel the pride through the pages. And I really liked that.
Down here, where we're at, weather changes, that's the way it goes. Sometimes it snows when everything's wrong. Sometimes it snows, but when it does, it doesn't last long.
I also appreciated his conversations about the relationship with Jay Farrar in the beginning and how that sort of came to be with Uncle Tupelo and then the breakup with that and the split between Sunvolt and Wilco. I felt like he was pretty candid. I don't really know Jay Farrar's side or haven't read much about that. And then the Jay Bennett in Wilco, that was really, I don't know. I just appreciated that he didn't ignore those when they're clearly there.
And that's one of the questions I wanted to ask you both. The Jay Farrar incident, Jay basically tells Jeff that, I think the phrase was, do you know what it's like to be on stage with somebody who thinks so much about himself? That's kind of a harsh thing to hear. Did that change how you think about Jeff Tweedy at all, that exchange and what Jay said to him?
I think Jeff's analysis of that comment, it's just perception is an interesting thing, right? Because perception is reality. And in Jeff's mind, he's just sort of consumed with self-doubt and is feeling that what he's doing is wrong and what he's just constantly questioning himself. And that came off to Jay Farrar as being sort of self-absorbed. Mm-hmm. It's just interesting how that can be, because I think in Jeff Tweedy's mind, it's absolutely just self-doubt. It's not thinking that he's the best, but he's just thinking that he probably could be better.
Right, right.
And I'll just say, and I'll be vulnerable here. That feeling of being really good and completely doubting, I get that totally. Mm-hmm. I totally get that feeling. So his perception of what Jay said. I can see him thinking, wow, he's out of line. What's he even talking about? And then he goes home and says, no, he said exactly the right thing because that is who I am. And I think he tried to explain that, but that's part of what puts me in the mindset of you have to remember that he's narrating his own story. And take that as it is, you know, this is how he sees it, but it may not be exactly how it is. And that doesn't take away from the book at all for me, because knowing that and knowing, seeing the way he writes about things and talks about things, I think it's really revealing of what it's like to be a creative person.
That's KAXE, KBXE music director Kari Hedlund and Center Stage Minnesota host Brett Carter. I'm Tammy Bobrowski, and we're talking about Jeff Tweedy's new memoir, Let's Go So We Can Get Back.
I just want to go back to this comment about Wilco and how it affects your life and how the lyrics affect your perception of the band and of Jeff Tweedy and that, because I think that's fascinating, because he does make the clear distinction sometimes that you as the listener should just get out of the way. You should just take the song as it is and figure out what it means and don't worry about it. And that's a strong statement. It's a little bit, I felt kind of pushback, and I don't even know the songs well enough to feel pushback.
I did feel that, because he does mention I Am Trying to Break Your Heart, which is the first song off of the Yankee Hotel Foxtrot album, which is one of my favorite songs. And I do go looking for meaning in those lyrics, because they're really interesting. Mm-hmm. I am an American aquarium drinker. I assassin down the avenue.
I am an American aquarium drinker. I assassin down the avenue. I'm hiding out in the big city blinking. What was I thinking?
And I've spent hours talking with friends about what this means, because they're such neat lyrics. And he says in the book, you know, these just kind of fit in to the rhyme,
wordplay,
and the cadence of the music and wordplay. Mm-hmm. And I'm a little disillusioned by that. Mm-hmm. But I know that I can get from that song what I want anyway.
See, and I took his statements about that a little bit differently, in that the songs, like I Assassin Down the Avenue, there was meaning there for him. Like, it's not exactly outright, and it's not exactly speaking in how we would say I'm feeling, but there was a feeling for him in that song, either in the music or the lyrics, that meant something. And to me, what he was saying by the listener, the listener's role is to take it your own way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not here for you to try to figure out the meaning, because sometimes I don't even know the meaning at the time of what I'm doing it.
Right.
And music is so subjective that if it means something to you when you heard that song, that's the meaning. You know, to me, that's how I sort of took that.
And I agree with you on that. And I think I agree that that is what he's saying. But I hear what Tammy's saying, too, of but there's some pushback on, oh, I just threw that in there.
Right.
Almost.
And flippancy.
That's,
right.
And that's a little bit hard. But I also say, you know, when the first time somebody introduced me to REM, I went and read a bunch of lyrics and I thought, why would I ever listen to this band? These don't make any sense.
This band is going nowhere.
You know, there's like the lyrics are crazy, you know, and it's like, why? But when you listen to it in a song, it has a whole different meaning. So I love that he says the melody, for him, the melody creates the song. The lyrics come second. That's fine. That's his process, not everybody's process. And I think that's really fascinating. And I literally love the line where he says, I hate it when a song is attempting to be clever.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would totally agree with that. If that's the only purpose of a lyric is to be clever, then that's really disappointing. I don't hear that in Wilco.
He had a really different experience, though, working on the Mermaid Avenue albums, because those songs were lyrics first. They were Woody Guthrie's songs, and they put them to new music. So
he
actually had a little bit of a experience doing it the opposite, flipping it around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which he seemed to enjoy more than he thought he would.
Right.
Well, and how, speaking of how the melody speaks to him stronger than the lyrics, was it during A Ghost Is Born, where he was talking about how the droning on sort of reflected where his mental status was at that point, and that the music really displayed what was going on in his brain. And that's just, I mean, musicians are all different, right? Like, lyrics mean something to one musician and the melody means, I mean, it's just, it's so subjective that it's interesting.
Reading this book, I never really thought about whether or not Jeff Tweedy was a good singer. And he clearly realizes that he is not the best singer, but he knows how to pick the kind of songs, the kind of pace that really fit his voice. He has done such a good job at that, because I don't really think about the quality of the songs. I just know that this is a song that's speaking to me and I really like it, and it's Jeff Tweedy.
Like that point where he said about his voice isn't a sustaining voice. He can't sustain notes. And so all of the songs, he doesn't like guitars that sustain notes. That was so interesting that he figured out ways to make his voice
to work with his voice. Exactly. Yeah. He grew up in Belleville, Illinois, right outside of St. Louis. What about his childhood struck you as far as where he went as a songwriter?
I found it fascinating just how music was instilled in him in such a young age. I mean, he was one of the 14-year-old traveling to shows at St. Louis and going to the nightclubs, and that he writes a piece about a Replacements show. Well, the Replacements were the opening act. So he went to this nightclub in St. Louis called Mississippi Nights, and they would go often when they were in their young teens. And I just think of 14-year-olds traveling. And I know a lot of people especially did this in past decades. I don't know if this happens anymore, but going to all ages shows and how impactful that was for him to like see other people making music. And Tommy Stinson was like 15 at the time he saw them opening. And the realization that, wow, somebody else is doing this that's my age, that's, you know, they're not pretty, they're not, don't have the best voice, they don't, you know, but they get up there and do this, and I want to do this. Mm-hmm. That was just, I really enjoyed that piece. And there was that whole story was just great, because they broke a hole in the floor, because the kids, the kiddie corral, they called it, the underagers were in this little corral area where they broke a hole in the floor, and he fell in it and like felt like he was gonna die that night.
That was gonna be his life story there. Well, I, you know, having negligent parents in some ways was a real benefit for him, because he did all this stuff. And then this experience that I think of, how do kids have this experience now when they have a digital world instead of an analog world, of going to the record store? And I love the scene or the conversation about being at the record store where they clearly don't want to sell me any of these albums. They just want to know that they have them and they're really good and you should know about them.
Like your atypical
high fidelity
record snob.
Yeah, and then that one of the guys ends up being his manager and what I liked about that whole deal was this idea that if you didn't listen to the music there, well, two sides of it. One was, the only way you find out about music is by reading a review. Imagine that. I can hardly conceptualize that idea of reading a review first, loving an album, having never heard a sound.
There was one he talked about where he didn't hear it for like 2 years.
Yeah.
But he'd been imagining what it sounded like from that review.
Right.
That was The Clash. I think it was The Clash. Yeah. That was the album he was talking about, one of the first Clash albums. And I think that's so interesting. And then the second thing is, if there's music out there that you're raised on and it goes away, it doesn't come back until now. But at that time when he's growing up, if this album is gone, there's nowhere to find it. Mm-hmm. It's gone. Mm-hmm. And so then you have to create music. I think for the creative process, that's what I was fascinated by, because then there's all sorts of stuff going on in his head that he's imagining what songs could sound like, and he's imagining what songs did sound like without even listening to them. That's just so amazing to me.
On the flip side of that, he talked at the end of the book about his son Sammy listens to everything, and talking about that whole mindset of when he grew up, if he didn't find it, it could be years before he'd hear it again, or if it was older, it was gone. And now his son Sammy is able to, and he was talking about other musicians where they're able to not just hear how the music has evolved into what's being made today, but they're able to easily go back and listen to the very inception of blues, you know, the beginning of rock and roll, all of those things, and then they can do what they want with it. So that was an interesting thing to me, because there's cool things about both of those.
Right. Exactly. Ways. Yes. That's what I mean. I think that was what was so fascinating, is that you have him in his era, has his way that he doesn't even have to do anymore either. And then you have the next generation, which can do it a whole different way, not necessarily better or worse. It's just different and fascinating. And it's all, I mean, that's the whole book is, for me, is about the creative process with bands in general, and with this band in particular, these bands in particular, is so interesting. And how we were talking about those shows, and how when he goes to those shows, he's just absorbing all that information and figuring out how to do it. And he doesn't come up with the replacements. That's not who he becomes mm-hmm. at all, even though that's, or the, what is it, the Mechanics, the Minutemen, mm-hmm. You know, he doesn't become them, they're Sex Pistols. That's not who he becomes at all, not even close.
But that's who influenced
But that's
him.
His influence. And mm-hmm. so it's really fascinating to think of what's going on. And he has some description of that, but it's kind of, that's where I would agree, kind of goes over the top of how that happens, because I don't think he knows how it happened. It's, I think he has a line in there where he says something about, I'm sure anybody watching he and Jay, anybody watching was probably, those two are going to start a band that always plays, that plays punk rock country hybrid with a smattering of critics and punk country hybrid loyalists will blow way out of proportion. So he had no idea. Yeah. I think what he's saying with that is he didn't know where they were going. Yeah. They just went with it. And that's really, that's fun.
Well, can I ask you a question, sure. Tammy?
Yeah.
When we first talked about this, you had said that you don't enjoy memoirs.
Right.
What did you think of the book?
I enjoyed it. It was, for me, it was a really fast read and it kept me involved in it, which is good. Sometimes if I'm reading it and I start getting distracted, then I know it's not going to keep me. But part of it is because I am a big Jeff Tweedy, Wilco fan, and part of it is the style. He has a really easygoing style that keeps you into the story, and he has an interesting story. He's gone, you know, he starts from his childhood, the record stores and the concerts and forming the bands, and then getting into his drug addiction and his marriage and his wife's health problems. There was a lot in there, and that really just kept me going.
I'll be honest with you guys, I read this in like a day, 24 hours, and it was such a good read. He kept it interesting. He talked about things but didn't go overboard on certain details, like even the existence of the band as it is today. He really only talked about for about 5 pages mm-hmm. and went into other details of his life. But there were times where the chronological order was a little...
It jumped a little bit.
It jumped a bit, mm-hmm. and I kind of had to read for a minute just to figure out where I was at. But that said, the reason for it was the subject matter, and that flowed in a way that worked for me. And I found the history of Uncle Tupelo and Wilco fascinating. I learned a lot that I didn't know. Reading these books makes you realize these people are normal people. And like he says in the end, his son said something like, "Dad, you're who you are when you were 18. Like, you're the same person no matter whatever amount of success you've had." You can totally get that from the book. I feel like he's a normal human being.
I think the book is a great insight into the history of a band and from one person's perspective. And I think where it shines is in talking about the impact on his life that those songs had. And I think knowing that because they had impact on his life, they had impact on the listeners. And he knows that. And it doesn't give him any more confidence to do the next album, but he knows that it made a difference. So I think that's really interesting. And I think the other strength of the book is the unveiling of the creative process, his creative process. That's only one person's creative process. You can't duplicate those things. And he's not saying that at all. He's just saying, this is what I did, and this is how it worked. And I think that's really fascinating. I think a person doesn't have to even know one Wilco song to find the book fascinating just for that. So I really appreciated that. And one of the things I think is interesting, there's no suffering in this book. I thought there would be because he's been through a lot. He's been through a lot, and there's no suffering. He goes through those times and talks about how difficult they were, but he doesn't just wallow in it, which you can think it could easily happen. Right. He moves through it, and his wife obviously is a strong woman who is a smart aleck.
She's awesome,
you know, and she's a big influence on him, and you get a hint of that through the book, that she's obviously a pretty strong helper in, along the way for him. So it's really, all that is interesting in terms of memoir, which sometimes memoirs can go a complete different way, which probably is why they're not always that interesting, because they're too much internal stuff, and he's more saying, well, this is kind of like general public information that goes a little deeper.
That was KAXE KBXE music director Kari Hedlund, Center Stage Minnesota producer and host Brett Carter. The book is Let's Go So We Can Get Back, a memoir of recording and discording with Wilco, etc.
Agree.